This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning with the latest vigorous shake that Donald Trump is delivering to the world order. In this case, the world economic order. The most immediate effect is, according to the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, that she has persuaded Mr. Trump to suspend the imposition of a 25% tariff on her country. Instead of it coming into force on Tuesday, it will be put on hold for 1 month while Mexico sends 10,000 additional soldiers to its northern border to try to stem the flow of smuggled narcotics into the United States. This is how the Mexican president announced the outcome of her conversation with President Trump.
He asked me how long I wanted to pause tariffs. I said forever. He asked me how much time. I told him a month. I'm sure that during this month we'll be able to deliver good results for his people and the people of Mexico. I told him that we've been working together on migration and that we've had good results. We always work respecting and protecting human rights. We talked on our common interest in reducing fentanyl trafficking from Mexico to the United States and other drugs as well, not just fentanyl.
And for his part, President Trump also used the word forever, albeit in a rather different context, about what he saw as Mexico's commitment to patrol its northern border.
We had a great talk with Mexico, and we had President Sheinbaum. We've had good relationships, but we have to stop fentanyl from coming in, whether I like somebody or not, and we have to stop the illegal aliens from coming in. And they've agreed to put in 10,000 soldiers permanently, like forever, 10,000 soldiers at their side of the border, and they have a big incentive to do.
Well, just before we came on air, Mr. Trump spoke to his Canadian counterpart, Justin Trudeau. No news from that yet, but we'll keep an eye on whether Canada might now also be temporarily spared these swinging taxes on their exports. Or, to be more precise, swinging taxes on the US importers who bring these goods in. Similar moves have been promised on China and longer term on the European Union. We'll have more on the economics of all this in a few minutes. First, Juan Carlos Baker is a former deputy trade minister for Mexico. He now lectures at the Pan American University. What does he make of the suspension of the Mexican trade tariffs?
Obviously, it's a very welcome development. Nonetheless, obviously, everything comes with a price tag. And as President Sheinbaum said on her message, Mexico agreed to certain actions against drug trafficking, deploying some members of the National Guard. I'm not surprised by those decisions. I think that that's really what Donald Trump wanted, you know, to have some sort of win to parade in front of his electoral base. There are still some details that we don't know. So it is unclear what we need to do in order not to be in the same spot 1 month from today.
Yeah. So in other words, it's not completely clear what the sort of metric of success, as far as Donald Trump is concerned, will be. But I guess the way in which we're talking about this suggests that, I mean, that is the important metric, though, isn't it? It's what Mr. Trump feels he has won over what will have been 30 days, that whether he feels that Mexico is doing enough, has managed to succeed in stemming the flow of illegal drugs. It will be down to him to decide what counts as success.
That's my supposition as well, Tim. And as such, well, it may change without previous notice. No, it's important to remember that Mexico was already in a similar position a few years ago. President Trump threatened to impose tariffs on Mexico, and then that was the first occasion, actually, that Mexico deployed the National Guard on its southern border to address illegal undocumented migration. Well, what we're seeing is just a repetition of that. The good thing, I suppose, is that we know how to handle those threats, and we know that no decision is truly final, correct? The flip side of that coin is that on the one hand, they will be highly unpredictable and volatile, and two, they will last for as long as Donald Trump is in the White House. We will never be on the clear, right? No one will.
I guess also, I mean, this is a reflection of the imbalance in power as well, which is the U.S., bluntly, is a much more important economic partner to Mexico than vice versa. And for that reason, given the size of the US economy, again, Mr. Trump has enormous leverage.
I would certainly agree that the size of the US's economy vis-a-vis Mexico's is working on its advantage. But I would probably be more hesitant on saying that Mexico is powerless. Mexico is the US's largest trading partner. So that means that if Mexico decides to go down that path, it has the ability to simply shut down entire industries, the automotive industry, auto parts, electrics, electronics, primary consumption goods. I'm thinking about anything that you can find in a grocery store, in a supermarket. It really comes from Mexico. So
that would come at an astonishing cost to Mexican employers, wouldn't it?
And US consumers. So this is the perverse game that we will end up playing if we go down that path. It is equally true that Mexican exporters will suffer than US consumers will suffer. That is why starting a trade war in North America makes no sense. Now, obviously, in the long run, but long run, I'm speaking about maybe 1-2 years, a trade war is going to be devastating for Mexico. But that doesn't mean that the US will just be untouched by this situation and by the possibility of Mexico retaliating. We have done this before. Mexico and the US have imposed tariffs on each other at least on 2 occasions. And in one of them, I was the vice minister of trade at that point in time. And I remember how Mexico targeted back then specific products, specific industries, and specific states. And the retaliation was designed to maximize the pain on those constituencies that were important for President Trump and the Republican Party in general. In the short term, Mexico can also inflict massive amounts of pain in the United States industries and consumers.
Juan Carlos Baker, former Deputy Trade Minister for Mexico. So what's the case inside the United States for these tariffs, or to be more precise, the threat of tariffs? Kenneth Raposa is an industry analyst with the advocacy group, the Coalition for Prosperous America. He told NewsHour the move by President Trump works as a negotiating tactic, but also as an economic tool. For example, in terms of rebalancing trade between the US and the European Union.
We might not ever have a $50 billion deficit with the EU, like we have now, as I said, about 250. But let's not make it grow so much. Maybe let's lower it. Let's get it the other direction. Maybe instead of you charging us 10% tariff for us to make and ship a Chevy Corvette to you, and we only charge you 3%, maybe we charge you the 10% tariff for your Mercedes that was made over there in order to balance that trade relationship between European Union or any other place.
Well, as Kenneth Raposa was intimating, we can think about tariffs as a tax on the import of certain goods. But what sort of effect do they really have for the US and for the global economy? Professor Kimberly Clausing is an economist based at the University of California, Los Angeles. First, what is the evidence that, as Donald Trump argues, the US is currently being taken advantage of when it comes to global trade?
That is far from clear. And in fact, the US trade deficit really is a reflection of the fact that the U.S. population and the U.S. government does very little savings. Each year, the federal government is spending about 24% of GDP, but only collecting about 18% of GDP in tax. And so that borrowing is part of what drives the excess U.S. consumption, which is what drives the deficit. So these tariffs won't help that underlying problem and are really a deeply misguided and distortionary solution.
You say they won't help that underlying problem, but in the short term, could they not help both by driving down the amount that US consumers do consume from abroad and also, I mean, in a sense, giving the US federal budget a bit of a boost from this tax?
Well, one thing to bear in mind is that when imports get reduced and we consume more U.S. products, in order to make those additional U.S. products, we have to get the resources from somewhere. And what that tends to do is shrink other sectors of the economy. And the export sector will get hit by these tariffs very hard because tariffs will raise the cost of the imported intermediate goods that they buy. That mechanism alone should drive down exports, but also foreign countries are going to be retaliating too. We've already heard about Canadian retaliation. The Europeans have a list, should we tariff them, of goods they would retaliate So what it tends to do is it shrinks exports as well as imports. While tariffs do generate some revenue, as you point out, the Trump administration is in favor of cutting taxes across the board in a much larger magnitude than these additional revenues would bring in. So they're really not addressing the fiscal deficit either.
Some of Donald Trump's supporters have said that, look, we've got evidence from what happened first time round when Donald Trump introduced tariffs, particularly on products from China. Yes, it wasn't maybe at this sort of dramatic level that we're seeing threatened right now, but they say that the evidence is that U.S. manufacturing did shift.
Well, there was some reshuffling of trade. That's certainly true. And we did see the share of Chinese trade decline in the wake of those tariffs. But it didn't change the underlying overall U.S. imbalance. It didn't lead to rising manufacturing employment. There have been several really good economic studies of those tariffs that found that employment and manufacturing actually suffered as a result of the tariffs because the effects of the retaliation and the supply chain disruption were greater than any positive effects for the protected industries.
Is there something to the argument, though, that the current global free trade system just, it's ended up working in a way that somehow doesn't quite favor the US? I mean, when one thinks, for example, of the type of state support that a lot of industries get, for example, in China.
It is true that the Chinese government subsidizes a lot of strategic industries, and that puts industries that compete with China at a disadvantage. And that's true for Europeans and Americans and many others. And the answer to that problem is to work together with our allies, not to bully our allies. This larger question about whether the United States has suffered due to open trade, I think we can answer definitively with no. We're one of the richest countries in the world. We've prospered by any measure. Now, it is true that there's been some disruption caused by trade, but one needs to bear in mind that there's many sorts of disruption in the economy, including from domestic competition, from technological change, from declining unionization, from rising market power. You know, we need to think about holistically, how do we support workers and make an inclusive economy? Whereas these tariffs might actually add insult to injury because they're a regressive tax that falls disproportionately on the poor. So I think this is a deeply misguided approach.
And that was Professor Kimberly Clausing from UCLA. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. Very shortly, we'll meet the pub landlady in England who promised all of her customers a free pint for every goal scored by their local team, only to see them win 7-0.
1 and 2, I was quite happy with. I said, you know, at least their customers will be happy. They're getting a few pints. And then I think by half time, I was starting to sweat a little bit. It was between elation and dread of any more going in, but happy that the team were winning. Then by 5, I think I was just praying for the final whistle.
Well, there was more to come, as we will hear in just a few minutes. One headline, it's our main story that we've been covering this hour. President Trump has agreed to pause the imposition of tariffs on Mexico by 1 month in return for increased efforts to combat cross-border drug trafficking. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. It had been said Spain's World Cup winning footballer Jenny Hermoso, one of the happiest days of her life, or it should have been. The day in 2023 when she and her teammates had won the World Cup. But it was a day, in her words, stained by an unwanted kiss on the lips from the then president of the country's football federation, Luis Rubiales. Today, Rubiales has gone on trial for sexual assault out of that incident. The case has raised questions not just about that former Football Federation boss, but broader issues related to women's place in football and in society. Guy Hedgecoe has this report from Madrid.
Campeona del mundo! The Spanish women's team celebrates winning the 2023 World Cup after beating England in the final. That triumph was soon overshadowed by a controversy caused by Football Federation boss Luis Rubiales when he celebrated by kissing one of the victorious players, Jenny Hermoso, on the mouth. He insisted the kiss was consensual. She said it wasn't. In the ensuing backlash against the Federation president, even Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez waded in.
The behaviour of Mr. Rubiales in this case shows that, in our country, there is still a long way to go when it comes to equality and respect between women and men.
Eventually, Mr. Rubiales was forced out of his job, and now he faces a possible jail sentence if found guilty of sexual assault. He denies the charge. He also faces a separate charge of coercion for allegedly trying to force Ms. Hermoso to say that the kiss was consensual. Prosecutors want him to be jailed for 2.5 years. 3 of his former colleagues are also on trial for coercion, including the coach of the World Cup winning team, Jorge Vilda. They all deny the charges. It's been a long, difficult journey for Spanish women's football. In a Madrid bar, I meet Isabel Fuentes, one of the first women to play for Spain's national team in 1971, when the country was under a dictatorship and female sport had little support.
The regime said, "We don't want you to play football, but we will just ignore you." And the federation put all manner of obstacles in our way.
But the recent World Cup victory means so much to Isabel that talking about it brings her to the verge of tears.
It was something we would have liked to experience, but we weren't allowed to. These players have won it for us. They lived out our dreams.
Younger players acknowledge that things have improved, even in the last few years. It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and I'm at a football training ground just outside Madrid. This is where a women's team called Olimpia Las Rozas trains several times a week. They play in the third division. Belén Peralta is a striker for the team.
When I was younger, like, girls playing football was kind of strange. You were told, like, oh, that's for boys, or that's not a girls' thing. And nowadays, you go to some places and you say, yeah, I'm a footballer, and that's so cool and attractive.
But the Rubiales case has drawn attention to what some see as continued sexist attitudes within football. The former Federation president believes this is a case of the law going too far. For Jenny Hermoso, it's a chance to ensure that Spanish football and society change for the better.
And that was Guy Hedgeco reporting from Madrid. Now to a moment of unfettered delight. It's early Saturday afternoon, and this is the sound inside a pub in Nottingham in the English Midlands. Hunters at the Gedling Inn pub beside themselves as their local team, Nottingham Forest, sticks 7 goals past Brighton in the English Premier League. They may have been whooping a bit more liberally because just before kick-off, the pub landlady had publicised an offer to try to get customers in. A free pint every time Forest scored. It proved to be an expensive stunt, as I've been hearing from that landlady, Becky Webster.
So we posted it about 40 minutes before the game started. We only recently got the channels to be able to play the Nottingham Forest games. So we wanted to make sure we got it out there so that everybody knew that we had it on. So I just thought, let's do a crazy offer and see what happens. Not expecting it to blow up like it has, and definitely not expecting them to score 7 goals.
Yeah, because who scores 7 goals? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy. 1 and 2, I was quite happy with. I said, you know, at least their customers will be happy. They're getting a few pints. And then I think by half time, I was starting to sweat a little bit. It was between elation and dread of any more going in, but happy that the team were winning.
Well, you have to say that.
Yeah. Then by 5, I think I was just praying for the final whistle.
Had you talked this through with your husband?
No. So he was working on our house with my son, and he was just getting loads of messages to say, oh, amazing offer at the Gedling Inn. And he was like, what are you on about? So came back, and he was like, what have you done? I was like, maybe a little something.
I can hear him chuckling in the background.
Yes.
chuckling in a friendly fashion, I hope, not sort of messing. But my goodness me, I mean, have you totted up how many pints you served that were free?
So I think we gave away about 300 pints in total.
Right. And
so quite a few.
Yeah, quite a few. So there were quite a few people who were, in that case, I mean, it presumably it was people were claiming more than just a couple of pints here and there. There were
some people were having just the odd couple, and then there was a few that wanted the full seven.
Right. Oh, my goodness. What was it like in the pub by the end of the game? I mean, people must have been absolutely delighted with the performance, but I mean, was it a little bit rowdier than normal?
No, not really, but everyone was just in great spirits. Everyone was singing, they were laughing, a few people were dancing around. It was such a great atmosphere. It felt kind of like it was like England had won the World Cup.
Yeah, well, it was an amazing scoreline and a fantastic comeback after a very disappointing match before. But just as far as you're concerned, I mean, it's one thing to give your punters a great time, which you did. Are you sort of counting the cost now?
We are, but it has been worth it, I believe, just for the exposure that we've got and just giving something back, I think, especially, you know, January can be a bleak long month. Mm. So it was nice to give back. And a lot of the customers were regular customers that come in and support us all year round. So it was nice to, you know, give them something back.
And, I mean, you've got a fair bit of publicity out of this.
Yes, definitely. I don't think we could have ever imagined. I'm not sure which is more dreamable, the 7-0 score or the publicity that we've managed to get.
Seven continents.
What did your husband say?
He says we're reaching all seven continents.
Yeah, quite. Well, indeed, they probably have. Well, they certainly have now that Becky has given an interview to the BBC World Service. She's the landlady at the Gedling Inn pub in Nottingham. And I apologise to her and to her partner, Cassian Prime, who you heard in the background there. I think I called him her husband. No, partner. But anyway, they were there together with that offer to for a free pint for every goal that Forest scored. And they only went and scored seven. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Regular listeners will remember that last week we were talking about the fall of Goma, a city in eastern Congo, to M23, a rebel group backed by Rwanda. Our reporter, Paul Ngea, has now been part of the first BBC team to get into Goma since last week's violence. He's had a look at who is ruling the city now.
The border between Rwanda and the Congolese city of Goma is a hive of activity. Sniffer dogs and policemen check and search men and women. Many of them arrive on foot, fleeing violence in Goma, the capital of North Kivu. Last week, the armed militia known as M23 overwhelmed government forces and seized control of the city. This raises a critical question. Who is in control now?
So we've crossed the Rwanda-DRC border, and driving through Goma town, I noticed that a key police post is now controlled by the M23, as well as the office of the governor of North Kivu. And to them, that suggests some form of control.
Vans riddled with bullets stand in front of a filling station, which was destroyed in the brutal clashes. The UN says at least 700 people have been killed as fighting gripped Goma. At the local hospital, doctors struggle to treat the large number of injured.
When we heard that M23 were coming to Goma, the hospital prepared contingency plans to receive patients. On the first day of fighting, we received 315 patients. There were children among them, and we treated them. We have received patients with gun wounds in the head, chest, stomach, hands, and legs. Some were injured by flying objects caused by explosions.
The patients receiving care describe the trauma they've endured over the past week.
I was in my house when the shooting started. Suddenly, my hand felt cold, and I realized I had been shot. My hand was shot, and I screamed for help, but they continued firing.
Away from the emergency rooms, a new calm seems to have settled on Goma.
I'm at Goma town in the capital of North Kivu, and there are signs of normality returning here. Commercial bike riders are out at work, and business premises are open, waiting for their customers.
But as one of the residents told us, this new normal hides insidious dangers.
When M23 arrived here, they surrounded the Congolese army. Some of them removed their military uniforms and threw away their weapons. Inside these heaps of military leftovers, there are grenades and live ammo, which can be very dangerous. We request the government that has taken over to remove them from the streets.
The Congolese government refutes M23's claims of a total capture of Goma. But the perception here is that, at least for now, the rebels are here to stay.
Paul and Gio reporting, and since he filed that report, M23 has now said that it's declaring a ceasefire to start on Tuesday for humanitarian reasons. You are the BBC World Service, and live from London, NewsHour. I'm Tim Franks. The US is the world's biggest spender on international development. The biggest tranche of that aid, worth about $40 billion, is administered through the agency USAID. The question today is, for how much longer? President Trump has said that USAID has been run by what he calls a bunch of radical lunatics. Elon Musk says that Mr. Trump wants to close the agency altogether. Washington-based employees of USAID have since been told to stay at home. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has now said that he's taking over as the acting administrator, in other words, boss of USAID. Speaking on a visit to a noisy factory in El Salvador, Mr. Rubio said he was determined to end what he called the agency's insubordination.
I'm the acting director of USAID. I've delegated that authority to someone, but I stay in touch with him. And again, our goal was to go in and align our foreign aid to the national interest. But if you go to mission after mission and embassy after embassy around the world, you will often find that in many cases, USAID is involved in programs that run counter to what we're trying to do in our national strategy with that country or with that region. That cannot continue.
Today's move follows the earlier directives to pause spending on international aid for 90 days while a review is carried out, and then at the end of last week an order to halt most of the work that's being carried out on the ground. Tom Hart is president and CEO of InterAction, an alliance of US-based international NGOs, many of whom receive USAID funding. What effects has he seen?
The stop work order puts a hold on existing funding. So the United States government has obligations to organizations and NGOs like our members, and some of them have already spent the money and are waiting for reimbursement. Everything has stopped. So the impact is there is medicine sitting on shelves that can't be distributed because the nurses had to be sent home. One of our members has a container full of donated medicine sitting on the port of Sudan that had to be abandoned. There's food donated from American farmers to feed hungry kids that is rotting. We saw Secretary Rubio expand to a life-saving humanitarian waiver, which was encouraging first step. But the fact is, organizations that even have received paperwork saying they may resume work were unable to draw down the funding to resume that work. So the system is broken.
In terms of what Marco Rubio has had to say today, which is to suggest that the agency is guilty of insubordination, that it is not following Mr. Trump's agenda, what American interests are, is there any evidence of USAID pursuing programs which might be considered to be political? For example, birth control programs, which might not be the flavor of this Republican administration. Is there any evidence of that?
I don't have information about specific actions taken by USAID staff, but this administration has made pretty clear through the campaign and up till now what they do not want to see. That is just a part of our foreign aid. And the administration has a right and responsibility to review all programs to make sure it's in line with the president's foreign policy. Every president does that. What's happening, though, is everything is being stopped, not just those things they have stated that they're concerned about. And I'll quote from Secretary Rubio even today. There are things that it does that are good, and there are some things that it does that we have strong questions about. Fair point. The things that they believe would be good are being stopped. And because the money is frozen, many of the NGOs that we represent can't last for 90 days while they review. They are shutting down. So Secretary Rubio may come back in 90 days and say, I'd like to do this, this, and this, and it won't exist. In fact, there are programs that President Trump signed into law that are now frozen. Women's entrepreneurship, helping the private sector make investments in resource-poor countries. So we know there's a lot that would fit within this administration's criteria as something they would keep going. We are trying to say, do your review while we continue to do the life-saving work all around the world. And then when you determine what you want to keep and what you don't want to keep, then we'll move forward from there.
Can I ask about the business of just whether USAID continues to exist as a discrete government agency? Right. But ultimately, if the US government in some form carries on distributing tens of billions of dollars of foreign aid, does it really matter what the branding on the agency is?
We think a separate independent agency is vital to do effective assistance. Again, we know there are programs that this administration does not favor, and Secretary Rubio has said that there are some that they do. We want that to be done as effectively as possible. But a really important point is to say that you can't just eliminate the agency by administrative fiat. It is codified into law, and the Congress must pass any dissolution of the agency. We obviously hope they don't do that, but we also have a serious process concern here.
I mean, clearly your interest is primarily in terms of helping NGOs to do their work abroad. But do you think, and it's something that isn't unique to the United States, but that maybe a better job need to be done at home in terms of trying to convince taxpayers it is worth spending the money on foreign aid when, you know, opinion surveys do suggest that people want money that is spent on foreign aid to be spent more at home?
There's no question that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what foreign aid. Polling has shown us over years that the American public think that foreign aid is 25% of the federal budget and that it's all wasted. Blank checks to foreign governments. Very little of it is that. And it's, of course, less than 1% of the budget. It is distributed by faith-based and community-based organizations like our NGOs, multilateral institutions where the United States money is leveraged many, many times by other countries. I mean, of course, there are some support directly to governments that we work with, strategic allies. That actually is mostly done through the State Department. But there's a tremendous amount of good that is done with just pennies on the dollar. And we frankly think ultimately saves the United States money in the long run. That's why you hear military officials, U.S. military officials say that they support this foreign aid because they know it creates stability, where the United States military will have to come in to help in conflict situations.
Tom Hart from the U.S. international NGO umbrella group Interaction. And some news just in. Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, has posted on X, the social media platform, that proposed tariffs on Canada from the U.S. will be paused for at least 30 days while Canada makes various commitments about trying to increase policing of its southern border. Now, we've talked about Donald Trump's forthright approach to foreign policy when it comes to the threat of tariffs. In a similar vein, his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has demanded that Panama make immediate changes to what he calls the influence and control of China over the Panama Canal, or he says the US will take necessary measures. He was speaking on the first stop on his six-day tour of Latin America. Tom Bateman has this report from the Secretary of State's first stop, Panama City.
Marco Rubio, fuera de Panama!
Fuera!
Un solo territorio!
Una sola bandera!
Well, they're chanting Panama, one territory,
one flag, and they want Marco Rubio out of Panama.
Earlier, protesters in Panama City burned effigies of Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. Riot police moved in on a crowd, firing tear gas and pulling demonstrators away. The clashes ahead of Mr. Rubio's visit were small in scale, but the anger triggered by Donald Trump's vow to retake the canal here is broad. Before travelling, the Secretary of State explained why the waterway is in the administration's sights. He was speaking to the Megyn Kelly Show.
If China wanted to obstruct traffic in the Panama Canal, they could. That's a fact. And it's my view that's a violation of the treaty agreement. And that's what President Trump is raising. And we're going to address that topic. That can't happen.
There we go. He's saying hello to us?
Yeah, he's saying hello to the
president. To you?
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. That was two horns, I think.
Yeah, they usually do that for the visitors.
Donald Trump's sudden policy pronouncement has hit Panama like the bulk carriers that blast their way up the canal.
So they're coming just to watch the boats coming to and fro?
Oh, yes. This is number one attraction in Panama.
We're on the locks of the Pacific Side entrance, hearing from workers, where Mr. Trump has claimed the canal is being run by China. The waterway is in fact owned and run by the Panamanian government under a neutrality treaty signed with the US decades ago. But Chinese companies have invested heavily in two of the five ports nearby.
Buenos dias.
Me alegro mucho conocerlos.
Next to the canal, I meet Edwin Cabrera, a former Panama congressman.
Genera un problema muy grave.
He's worried.
Have you ever seen any Chinese soldiers?
Nunca.
Never. The problem is Trump confuses the operation of the canal with the operation of the ports, says Mr. Cabrera. There are no Chinese soldiers here, he says. As he arrived at the presidential palace, there was a thumbs up from Marco Rubio. But the two-hour meeting with President Mulino didn't cool tensions. Afterwards, the Secretary of State issued an ultimatum, saying if Panama didn't take immediate action to end Chinese control of the canal, the US would take measures to protect its rights. Soon after that, Mr. Rubio walked with officials atop one of the locks, overlooking the Panama Canal.
Are you threatening military action against Panama, Mr. Secretary?
There was no answer from him on that, although Panama's president said he didn't see any serious threat of US military action, proposing technical talks to ease Washington's concerns over China. But amid the stalls selling Panama hats and souvenirs in the old city, few concerns were being eased.
Do you speak English?
English.
Yes, what's your name?
Maddie.
When Donald Trump said he's going to take back the Panama Canal, what did you think?
We're insulted. Totally insulted. Because we put up with the American presence for 100 years. Every penny that came out of the canal went to the United States. We got pittance. No more American in the middle of Panama. Absolutely not.
So what do you think of Marco Rubio showing up here? You're walking away.
Panama's Chinese community, dating back nearly two centuries, was celebrating Chinese New Year just as Mr. Rubio had landed. President Trump wants to make an example of Panama in this region to fend off Chinese investment in America's own backyard. That is hardly a change of desire from a US administration. The question is one of approach, and whether sparking a major diplomatic standoff with a much smaller partner country will deliver their desire.
And that was Tom Bateman reporting from Panama City. You're listening to NewsHour.
You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC.
As the ceasefire holds in Gaza, medical evacuations have resumed. The World Health Organization estimates that there are between 12,000 and 14,000 critical patients who need to be evacuated for treatment. Among them is Habiba al-Askari, a child suffering from a rare blood condition which causes her limbs to develop gangrene. The BBC's Fergal Keane is at the Al-Karama airbase on the Jordanian-Israeli border, and he's been following her case.
Well, at any moment now, Habiba will arrive here by ambulance and be transferred to the helicopter behind me. And from here, it's another journey. 30 minutes by air, approximately, to Amman, where doctors will then try to establish a precise diagnosis so that she can get the treatment she so badly needs. Habiba al-Askari is suffering from a rare blood condition which has caused her to lose movement in three of her limbs. Two legs and an arm have gone black with a type of gangrene. Doctors treating her in Gaza's Nasser Hospital said she would die if she wasn't evacuated. Her mother, Rana, described Habiba's suffering.
If she asks me for a biscuit, I cannot give it to her. If I hand it over to her, she gives me a look. I can't describe to you the look that she gives me. I can only pray to God to heal Habiba and make me a miracle on earth in healing her.
Habiba is being treated by a team of doctors from the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. Dr. Riaz Wasaid from Manchester told our journalist about the seriousness of her condition.
We are really pushing to try and get her medevaced out of Gaza as soon as possible in order to save her life and to try and salvage whatever is possible out of her limbs.
Habiba's evacuation was postponed on several occasions. At one point, Israel approved Habiba's transfer but refused to allow her mother travel with her. That decision was rescinded last night in what Israel called an extraordinary humanitarian gesture. Then there was confusion over whether her 12-year-old brother could travel.
It was a tiring effort, but it brought a result and I got permission. Now my son Sohaib is left. Oh God, please let me not endure the fire of being away from him.
That issue was quickly resolved and Habiba, her mother and brother are on their way here to Amman.
And that was the BBC's Fergal Keane reporting from the Jordanian-Israeli border. The French film director Christophe Rougier has been convicted of sexually assaulting the actor Adèle Haenel when she was underage. Rougier was given a four-year sentence but will be spared prison. He'll spend 2 years under house arrest. The court heard that Rougier had abused Haenel when she was between the ages of 12 and 15. She said that she'll quit acting over what she called the French film industry's refusal to address sexual abuse. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, has been following the case.
23 years ago, when she was but 12 years of age and starred in this film by Christopher Rougier called The Devil, Les Diables, about a pair of children who are a brother and sister, and they're kind of on the run and they develop a relationship. And in many ways, the film was problematic in itself. It had sexualized scenes, which, you know, would certainly raise eyebrows today, in which she appeared. But the abuse was not on the film set. The abuse, as characterised in the court and of which she's now being convicted, was afterwards, in the 2 years after that, when she and he, that is the actress Haenel, aged 12 to 14, and Rougier, developed some kind of relationship, and she would go round to his flat, often brought by her father to the flat, and in the flat where Rougier, the director, was saying he's obsessed with her, she thought she was marvellous and the rest of it, she said that he abused her then, that all this memory was suppressed for her, she said, but then a trigger, in fact it was watching a film about Michael Jackson many years later, brought her to sort of remember it, regurgitate it and feel the kind of catharsis of talking about it.
And in terms of Rougier, I mean, he has been given this 4-year sentence, but he's avoiding prison. Has he spoken at all.
What his lawyers are saying is that they believe this is a miscarriage of justice. He's always denied this, the allegations. He's saying that it's a fake memory, in essence. And the lawyers are saying that, you know, the court has bent its back before public opinion and the undoubted sense of outrage among the public about cases of abuse of this nature, and that therefore this was a bad conviction, that the court should have leaned more favourably towards their client because there should have been a legitimate benefit of the doubt.
Mm. But Enel herself, I mean, she has talked, hasn't she? I mean, in the past, about how French cinema has just airbrushed this type of abuse.
I mean, I think that this case is significant because it really was the kind of déclencheur, the trigger, the starting gun for a lot of people to speak openly about abuse in French cinema and in other spheres of life, but particularly in cinema here. And we, you know, there have been other cases ever since, notably now involving Gérard Depardieu. Adèle Haenel is clearly a very troubled soul who's gone through an awful lot because of what happened here, but also I think in relation to her parents, There's obviously an awful lot of stress and breakdown there as well. You know, what a lot of people are saying here in France is, well, you know, clearly what Rudger did was absolutely unacceptable. It's now been established in court that this abuse happened. But, you know, why was a 12-year-old girl in the first place in this situation of a film which was clearly very, very sexualized in its content? And why in French cinema in general are these figures, these auteurs, these directors, these individual all-God directors given such latitude to pursue their visions, which so often have involved sexuality, child sex, you know, exploring these taboos, you know, and why were they so often backed by progressive opinion, which people like Rudger were back then?
But Enel herself, I mean, am I right in saying she says that she's done with the form?
She's become very, very political. She's a member of a tiny, tiny micro left-wing Trotskyist party now and is very, very outspoken on issues like this. And she's broken completely with cinema, which she says is, you know, a tool of macho, patriarchy, capitalistic, forces, which she denounces from the bottom of her heart.
And that was our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.